We're part of a series at the moment on the mind training, on the 7-point mind training. And it's a training method for becoming a bodhisattva. So that's a being who wishes to become enlightened, not just for their own happiness, but for the happiness of all beings everywhere. And it's the 7-point mind training is a very wide-reaching, all-round practice. So we saw last week that it includes a meditation practice, and it also includes slogans, a number of slogans that we can choose if we want to take on as our practice in our everyday lives. In fact, one of its main emphases of the 7-point mind training is that it is our everyday lives is exactly where we need to practice. If we think that we practice on retreat, that's good, or we practice sitting on the meditation cushion, that's good as well, but it's in our everyday life, how we respond in the moment, that is where we really practice. And that everything that happens to us can help us to wake up to reality. So we've had these lovely slogans on cards that you can get one later and take home and complete the set. There are going to be a few other cards, but they're not slogans. So this is the last slogan card. So how lucky you are to be here tonight to get this very amazing one. Okay. So what's going to happen in the next couple of weeks is we're going to do an urban retreat as part of Sangha Night. So those of you who've been fortunate enough to go away on retreat know that it can make quite a difference to go away somewhere where you can do more meditation, have a bit more time to reflect, have a bit of a slower life, be in nature, be in a beautiful place. And that can have quite an effect on you when you come back home. But what happens is, of course, is we come back home into our busy lives, perhaps living in the city, and because the conditions are no longer there, those positive mental states start to change, and we find ourselves back in our old ways. Perhaps a bit different, but we just find some old patterns coming back. So what's great about an urban retreat is it gives you a chance to be right in the middle of your everyday life, but to take on a few practices that you choose that might help you to change, to have some of the effect of being on retreat. It's a very kind of mind training thing to do, to bring a retreat right into your everyday life as you go about it. So next Tuesday, Vidanya will start off talking about what's involved. And then over the week from Tuesday to the Tuesday after that, if you want to, you could decide to do a bit more meditation perhaps. You could decide to be in touch with a few buddies to support what you're doing. It's up to you. So if you're interested in that, come next week. But actually, even if you're not interested in actually doing the retreat for some reason, like something's happening that week and you really don't want to do it, it's still worth coming because Vidanya will talk about some ways that are really good to put into practice if you want to change any habit, some really good ways of looking at things. So it's worth coming anyway. Okay, so so that's something that we'll be doing. Okay, so I said before I talked about the urban retreat that the 7-point mind training is about training to be a bodhisattva. Or you could say it's training all of us training to wake up together to the fact that we're interconnected and to the fact that we suffer more if we obsess about ourselves. And there's a basic misunderstanding we have about reality, which means we grab onto pleasant experiences and we push away unpleasant experiences for ourselves. There's a sense in which we think we're the center of the universe. And to the extent we think we're the center of the universe, the extent we suffer, actually. So the mind training is not just about improving ourselves and becoming individually happier. Though, of course, that will happen if we practice things like we've heard in the talks in the last few weeks. We've heard about developing gratitude. We've heard about taking responsibility for our actions. We've heard about becoming aware of others as human beings. So all those things, if we practice them and put them into our lives, will actually help us to become happier. But actually, the 7-point mind training is about really radically changing the way we see ourselves and the way we see reality. And sometimes that means the slogans challenge us to see the world in a radical way, a very different way from how we see things normally. So a few weeks ago, going back a while now, you might remember Pradaya told us about how a main aim of the mind training is to change what we think of as adverse or difficult in daily life into positive opportunities. So normally, if we come across something that's difficult in life, something bad happens to us, our very human and normal reaction is to go, that's really bad, that's really bad. And what this is saying is actually, because bad things are going to happen to all of us, we can change our attitude to those bad things. So it's not saying go out and seek bad things. It's not saying that bad things are kind of good. It's saying they're just going to happen to us all. We're all going to experience dukkha. And what we can do is we can change how we respond to that. So last week, Aryadasa talked about turning how we might respond to dukkha. And he talked about it as being disappointment, which I think is a really good way to think of it. It's that unsatisfactoriness. It's the fact that life disappoints us. I've got a phrase that I must have come from a poem, I think. It's something about life breaks its promises. There's something for me about, yeah, that life breaks its promises. And we can change, we can transform that dukkha into something that connects us to other people. So that's transforming adversity into compassion that Aryadasa talked about last week. And this week I'm talking about a second way that the mind training gives us to transform our dukkha into something positive, which is through wisdom. So compassion and wisdom. This week we're looking at wisdom. Okay, but first of all, I want to tell you about something that happened to me only last night, actually. So I was on the top of a really high mountain, and there was a guy, a very grumpy guy, operating a cable car system up there. And he said, you need to get in the cable car. He said to me and my companion, you need to get in that cable car, and you need to get down fast, because there are some people trapped. They're trapped underground, and there's a flood coming, because there's a high tide, and they're going to be drowned. So it's really important you get in the cable car and you go down, down the mountain into the cave. As I say this, it's kind of sounding very significant. Anyway, so so he was very grumpy, but we kind of, me and my companion got in. And we're sitting in the cable car, this very, like, a huge drop beneath us. And I looked at my companion and I thought, I think this guy's my boyfriend. But that's really weird because he's really young. And then I thought, and I'm quite old, so why would I have such a young boyfriend? And then I thought, well, maybe I'm quite young, actually. Maybe that's the truth of the situation, is I'm quite young and he is my boyfriend. I don't know. But anyway, he was really grumpy as well, a bit like the cable car operator. And he said, you know, I really don't want to go and help these people because I don't think me or you have got the tools to do this. We're not ready to do this. And I thought, he's right, actually, he's right. Whoever it is, he's right. And then I was looking down and I saw, a bit bizarrely, a bit horribly, that there were a number of dead bodies lying at the bottom of this kind of mountain. There were people who'd committed suicide by jumping off the mountain. And I was like, oh my God, that's really awful. That's really awful. Anyway, so my dream continued. My dream continued. That was a dream that I had last night. But last night, that seemed really real to me, really real to me. It wasn't until I woke up I thought, that's just, you know, that didn't really happen. That didn't really happen. And what we're exploring today is that we can see all life, all our life, as being like a dream. It's something that we can wake up, it seems completely real at the time, our experience, but we can wake up from dreams and we can go, oh, that was only a dream, thankfully. You know, we might have been chased by a monster, we might have had a really horrible time, but we go, phew, that was only a dream. So the slogan today is not that one, is all dharmas are dreamlike. Or in a fuller version, see all dharmas as dreamlike. So an important thing to see here is the word dharma has a slightly different meaning in this context than we're probably used to. So we're used to having the word dharma refer to the Buddha's teachings, and it does refer to that, but it also actually refers in this situation to all phenomenon. So I suppose because dharma is like a really important word, like lots of words, it got really taken in lots of different ways by Buddhists, and here it means phenomenon. So you could see it as all phenomenon are dreamlike. All phenomena are dreamlike. So the question is, what would it be like if we saw everything in our daytime experiences as dreamlike? In some way, we are creating the world all the time. So as Anais Nin said, we don't see things as they are, we see them as we are. So just as our minds create a real world seemingly when we're asleep, so they do when we're awake. Perhaps it's the same perceptual process as dreaming, I don't know, but in a way it doesn't really matter how it works. This slogan and the others we've looked at are a method. They're not necessarily a truth, if you see what I mean. It's like they're a method, they're a way to approach our experience. So the question is, with this particular slogan, what would happen to us? How would our experience be different if we asked it all the time? Can I see this experience as being dreamlike? That even though it feels real, it's not necessarily true. So So what the mind training does here is it helps us to see through the stories we tell ourselves that cause us suffering, and in that process we move closer to wisdom. So saying that all dharmas are dreamlike, or see all dharmas as dreamlike, is another way of looking at this, is saying we're all storytellers. And as human beings, we live in a world where, you know, it's very complicated, even on the most basic sense, in terms of all the sense information that we receive all the time. We're bombarded with information. Even our perceptual understanding of the world is a story. So our senses have a huge amount of information coming in, which they can't process, so they tell us stories. So apparently, we're continually making up a lot of our experience. So I don't exactly know how they've worked it out, but you know, if we see some wallpaper or something like that, our brain only needs to see a little bit of it, and it recreates the rest of it. There's some way in which we really are recreating. The same thing would happen with sound, would happen with all that sense information that's coming into us. What happens is the brain knows from our past experience what it thinks will happen, and then it fills in the gaps for us. So you might have had an experience like I've had, I'm sure you have had, when I was walking along once and I saw a white shape in a tree. And I thought, wow, it's an owl. It really looked like an owl. I was like, hey, amazing, an owl in daylight. And then I thought, no, it's not an owl. It's a child's kite. And I really saw the shape of a kite. Got a bit closer. And I thought, oh, it's a white plastic bag. But what was really interesting is I'd seen each one as if it was real. I didn't kind of go, that vaguely looks like an owl, that vaguely looks like a kite. I'd actually seen an owl and a kite. Something in my mind had actually filled in the details. So there's something about everyday life can in that way, is dreamlike, isn't it? It's a bit like I was dreaming an owl, I was dreaming a kite. Maybe I was dreaming a plastic bag as well. So we're as human beings, we're dreamers, we're storytellers, we're interpreting the world through our own minds. So we could think about how we feel about ourselves as dreamlike. We could think about how we see other people as being dreamlike. We could think about how we see the world and culture we live in as being dreamlike. And we could see the nature of reality as being like a dream as well. So I'm just going to run through those areas and just think a little bit about each one of those. So the stories or the dreams we have about ourselves. So we believe all sorts of things about ourselves that are real to us, but they're not true. Just like a dream. They're real, but they're not true. And I got that phrase from someone called Tara Brach, who's an American psychologist, and she's a Buddhist practitioner. And she uses the phrase, and I find it really helpful, because it's like they feel real. They are real in some way, but when we look at them and explore them, they're not true. And I think many of psychological therapies, whether it's psychoanalysis or cognitive behavioral therapy, they're helping us to distinguish that just because we think or feel something, it doesn't mean it's real. It might feel real, it is real to us, but it isn't true, and we don't have to believe it. We can choose whether we believe it or not. There's a phrase from Mark Twain that I really like, a quote. He says, "I've lived through some terrible things in my life, some of which actually happened." And there's a way, isn't it, that we kind of live this life, much of which, a lot of suffering, and a lot of it doesn't actually happen. And I think these stories, these dreams that we tell ourselves, they also give us a self-identity, which is not necessarily helpful sometimes. It's interesting, I found out, that the word identity is from Latin, identidem, which means over and over. So it's a bit like when we dream ourselves, when we tell ourselves these stories, we're creating an identity, because we're just kind of going over and over again in this rut of being. And sometimes, sadly, we create stories for ourselves, dreams in which we suffer. So an extreme example would be a person who's anorexic. So a starving person will look into a mirror and see themselves as fat, even though to anybody else they're obviously not. Their reality, they are dreaming that they are overweight and need to lose weight. And we might not have such extreme experiences, but we will all be telling stories all the time that can really stop ourselves from being happy. So at the weekend, I sometimes go for walks on my own in the countryside. And sometimes I'm walking along and I go, I'm so sad and lonely because nobody wants to come for a walk with me. And then so that's one story, that's one dream, which is quite sad. And then another one is, oh, I'm so wild and adventurous and independent. Look at me, a woman of my age, out in the hills on her own. So sometimes if people pass me, my story is they're thinking, oh, she's got no friends, how sad. Or they're thinking, wow, look at her. It's like, you know, it's completely up to me how I see that particular situation. And that's such a small example, isn't it, you know? So I suppose it's interesting to ask yourself, What stories do you tell yourself that it might be helpful to regard as being has the nature of a dream? So some of the stories we have are things we might feel that we're too quiet and too shy, or we might feel that we're too loud and too extrovert. Our story might be we've had a really good life, or our story might be we've had a difficult life. One story that I think we can hold at the same time, two stories, is one that, you know, you're a really amazing person with loads of talents and abilities which haven't been recognised by the world yet. Or maybe you're just a really rubbish person who needs to hide away. It's kind of interesting that I can hold both of those at the same time. Anyway, whatever your stories are, whatever this kind of dreamlike of the dharmas of yourself that you're experiencing are, and however, you know, contradictory they are, how bizarre they are, they're having an effect on you and they're having an effect on other people. And often they're unconscious, these stories. We don't even know we're telling them to ourselves. And I think it's a really important part of spiritual development that we bring into consciousness our stories about ourselves. And we can find out what is true, what's reality, and what is just dreamlike. So this slogan suggests that when you suffer from your own thoughts and feelings about yourself, this slogan would suggest you ask yourself, how would it be if I thought all of that was just a dream? So all my life I've thought I was rubbish and unlovable, and it's made me miserable, and it's made me miserable to be around. This isn't necessarily true of me, actually, but sometimes I think that. But it turns out that thought was just a dream. It was just a dream. I've woken up, hooray, I don't have to live by that thought anymore. So there's the first thing we can think of is about what in our own experience would it be helpful to us to see as being of the nature of a dream, something we can just wake up from. So the second area that we're having stories and dreams are about other people. So other people behave in all sorts of ways, don't they, that seem to me, or to us, weird and wonderful. And it's like I'm always surprised by and bewildered by what people do. And I'm always making up theories about it, speculating. It's a bit like I feel like I'm a detective sometimes. I'm kind of looking for clues to try and understand why people do what they do. And I often get together with someone else and go, well, do you think it's because of that thing? Or is it because of that? You know, I'm really like trying to understand them. And I pass my theories on to other people when we have that conversation. They pass theirs on to me. But actually, I wonder how often I come up with the truth when we do that. Because actually we're so contradictory and confusing, aren't we? People are just very rich, so much to us. And actually, I'm going to be dreaming other people just as they're dreaming me. So if I treat somebody like they're dishonest, they're probably more likely to behave dishonestly, for example. We do need to try and understand other people, don't we? And it can help us to understand people's tendencies. But I think we need to be really careful when we generalise. And we can often be very wrong when we speculate about people's motivations. If I'm brave enough and I ask somebody about their motivations for doing something, it's interesting how different it often is from the motivation I will have given to them. So if we're finding that we're suffering a lot because of our thoughts and feelings about other people, we could ask ourselves, well, how true are those, are our ideas about them? Is my suffering because I'm projecting something onto the other person? So that behaviour I find really annoying, it's probably triggering something in me. It's not universally shared. And actually that also applies to people when people are amazing. Quite often we project amazingness onto people. It's like that's something we're giving them. But that usually doesn't cause us so much suffering. It's normally when we find somebody really annoying that it's something we want to do something about. And just over the last few days, because I've been thinking about this quite a lot, I've not been speculating so much. So in discussion with people, I've just gone, oh, well, I don't know why they did that. And actually, it's been quite a relief, because it's just like you don't have to get into all this stuff. You know, it's just like, you go, well, I don't know, but they did. So let's just kind of move on from there. And so there's a kind of just a more pleasant dream, as it were, that I've been living in there. And I think a practice that we can do that can really help with other people, of course, is the metta bhavana. So if we do the metta bhavana for the person we find difficult, we're building a bigger picture of them. We're getting a fuller picture than the aspects we normally dwell on. And I've had the experience, probably many of you have here, where I've been with someone that I used to find very difficult. And I've actually really enjoyed them. I did the metta bhavana for them, you know, over a long period of time, and things changed, and then I'd be with them. And then I'd go, oh, I remember how I used to see this person. And actually, it did feel like, oh, that was just a dream. You know, I used to find this person really difficult, but now I can enjoy them. I can enjoy them. So that's other people. So the third area is the dreamlike qualities of how we see the world. So the stories we tell about the world. So the world is very complicated, isn't it? This culture we live in, this society we live in, it's very complicated. So we've got loads of stories about that, which we'll have just received from other people and our early experiences. We might think it's a scary world. We might think it's an amazing world waiting to be explored. That might be the story we tell. That might be the way we're dreaming the world. Maybe we might think we need to look out for ourselves because nobody else will. Or we might need to think the world will look, we might think the world will look after us. I can relax. That's just another way of dreaming, I suppose. We might have ideas about money. You might think you need 10 grand a year and you'll be happy, or 20 grand a year and you'll be happy, or 100 grand a year and then I'll be happy. Or maybe you might have like a kind of, your story might be that just to think about money is distasteful. So it's a bit like all these stories you could see as being dreamlike. They're just ideas that we have about things. And I won't carry on about those, but these stories that we have will also create their own realities. You know, if we think that the world will look after us, we'll probably behave in a way where it might actually. Or if we think we have to really look out for ourselves and be really tight, we'll create a world in where, you know, we might find we do need to do that. So to some extent, how we think about the world will create it for us. And there are many other views we'll have about the world. And quite often our political views are ones that we hold very tightly. Well, I hold mine tightly. And there's something about, I think I'm definitely right. And an actually quite exhilarating thing for me through my Buddhist practice has been to explore those and question them and not hold on to them so tightly. It's a bit like sometimes I didn't even know that that was a view. I thought that's how it really is. And sometimes we really don't know, you know, we really don't know. We can be open, we can, to explore those ideas. So there's something about we think about how we see the world, and, you know, it's the water we swim in. It can be really hard to see that because we just think that's how things are. But the more we explore that, the more we can free ourselves. We can see those things as being dreamlike. So the last area that we could look at where we think about, we might see it as dreamlike, is the nature of reality itself. So the Diamond Sutra, which is a very key Buddhist text, says to us, so should one view all of the floating world. A drop of dew, a bubble in a stream, a flash of lightning, a star at dawn, a phantom and a dream. Or Shakespeare said in The Tempest, we are such stuff as dreams are made on. So there's a sense there that actually the nature of reality, we should see it as being dreamlike. So if you've done a sevenfold puja, a ritual, you've probably heard the Heart Sutra, which we chant in that ritual. And if you haven't done it yet, we're going to do it the week after next, so you'll get a chance to hear it. And the Heart Sutra comes from a collection of very ancient Buddhist texts called the Perfection of Wisdom texts. And in the Heart Sutra, we recite that things don't exist as we think they do. All our senses, all our experiences don't exist in the way that we think we do. They are all empty of inherent existence. They are mysterious. The Heart Sutra says that whenever we try to describe anything in words, whenever we try to pin anything down, we're going to lose it. We're going to lose it. One section of the Heart Sutra says, nor is there pain or cause of pain or cease in pain or noble path to lead from pain, not even wisdom to attain. Attainment too is emptiness. So you might recognize the Four Noble Truths there. That's pain is suffering or dukkha. Nor is there dukkha or cause of dukkha or cease in dukkha or noble path to lead from dukkha. Now that's interesting, isn't it? Because in the intermediate course, we say this is key Buddhism. This is really important Buddhism, these Four Noble Truths. And it is. But in the Heart Sutra, it says, even that doesn't exist like you think it does. And then it goes on to say, not even wisdom to attain. So this whole thing we're trying to do, in fact, I'm talking about how to get wise. And the Heart Sutra says, well, it just doesn't exist like that. So it's all kind of, anyway. Well, in a way, I love it, actually. I love it that in Buddhism, we kind of go, here are the key teachings, but don't hold on to them. Don't get too caught up in them. Because I don't think the Heart Sutra is saying that that enlightenment is important. It's not saying that the noble truths aren't important, but it's saying that they're all stories in a way too. They're in a way we're dreaming those, because the real experience is much more than us talking about them. So that we need to hold lightly to everything, even key important teachings, particularly key important teachings, actually, because us humans have got such an ability to hold on tight to things, to make things concrete, to be literal about things, and we actually need to be light. We need to see even the nature of reality as being dreamlike. So I don't know if an enlightened person, what they would do. Would they have woken up from the dream? Or would they perhaps be seeing the dreams for what they are in their experience? I don't know. But there's something for us about we can start to see through our experience and see it as being dreamlike. So a couple of things to bear in mind. So the first was, I'm not saying because it's all dreamlike, it doesn't matter what we do. Because I could choose one of you and hit you around the head and go, well, it doesn't matter, I'm just dreaming it. But of course it would matter, because you would suffer if I did that. So it's not saying that it doesn't matter what we do at all. It's saying apply the idea of seeing things as dreamlike to your experience and see what effect that has. And actually, it's also not saying that there isn't a reality. You know, if I got hit by a bus, I'd be really aware of the reality of that, okay? What it's asking us to do is in our normal everyday lives, with quite small things to start off with, what if I thought of this difficulty, this adversity, as if it were dreamlike? What if I responded to the situation with that thought? And we're more likely to do that when things are difficult, of course. We could probably also do it when things are pleasurable, but we're not so motivated to. Like, I know, like, when I'm experiencing suffering, it's like I really want to do what I can to get out of that. Whereas when things are pleasurable, I'm like, well, this is fine. I'll carry on with this. But it's just as equally dreamlike, of course. Okay. So the second part is what to do with this. What can we do with seeing all dreams as, all dharmas as dreamlike, all phenomena as dreamlike? So it gives us a freedom, perhaps a bit like lucid dreaming might be. So it's a bit like in lucid dreaming, a person knows that they are dreaming and they can make choices about what they do in that dream. So perhaps that's what it could be like. When we're aware that things are dreamlike, that they're stories, that they don't have necessarily, that although they feel very real, they're not necessarily true, we could make choices as well. So people who've seen the film The Matrix, it's like we could be a bit like Neo in The Matrix. It's like we could be part of the delusion. So there's a bit at the end where he's kind of like amazingly dodging all these bullets because he's slowed time down. Anyway, and it's a bit like we might not exactly be able to do that, but it's a bit like we could, in some ways, it's like the more we see that we are, what we are in is dreamlike, the more we can work with that. So we can imagine ourselves a different reality. We don't have to be limited by our society and upbringing. We can choose how we respond to our experience. So we can evaluate what we do. We could think, if I live according to these ways of living, does it promote awakening? Does it open me up or does it close me down? And we can reframe our experience as well. So ways to reframe your experience. And we can do that in just very everyday ways. So for instance, if you're on a diet, you probably start to feel quite hungry because you're eating less calories. And there's a bit of you that go, oh my God, this is terrible. I'm really hungry. I better go and eat some more. But you could reframe that. You could go, hooray, my diet is working because I'm feeling hungry. It shows it's working. Or for people who are giving up smoking, those cravings can be really overwhelming and people think, oh, I'm going to have to start smoking again. But actually you could go, wow, I'm really desperate for a cigarette. That's a great sign. It shows that my fight against this addiction is really starting to have an effect. If you go out for a walk on your own or with other people, it doesn't matter, but you can, you get really tired, you might think, oh God, I'm really tired, what a waste of a, I shouldn't have done this. Or you could think, it's great, I'm increasing my fitness, I'm getting fitter. If you're doing something, I don't know what you'd be doing, jumping out of a parachute or jumping from a plane by parachute or something, you could be thinking, this is really scary, or you'd go, wow, this is really exciting. This is really exciting. You might think, you might find yourself doing something, you might find yourself becoming a mitra for instance. And you might kind of go, oh, I'm not the sort of person who can do this. And then you'd go, wow, well, this is an opportunity to find new ways of being, new resources in myself, and so on. There are ways that very kind of, you know, ways that we respond to the world that we can reframe and we can help them. And I suppose what we can do really is we can try and base our lives on ethics, not on our whims. Not because we like something, we dislike something, but we can kind of find a framework that we choose that we want to live by. When we find ourselves experiencing adversity, we could ask ourselves a few more questions. We could ask ourselves, maybe this opportunity will give, this situation is going to give me an opportunity to grow, to do some spiritual bodybuilding. It'll give me an opportunity to see through my stories. So something happens that you really don't like. I don't know, you know, people often have classic stories, don't they? Like their relationship broke up and it was devastating, or they got ill and it was devastating. But then a few years later, they go back, they look back and they go, that was when my life really changed. That's when I really started to make changes and see what was very important to me. So we can, at the time, we can go, okay, well, maybe actually in a few years, I might look back and I might go, this was a really important time for me. And another way we might reframe in a, or ask ourselves in a situation of adversity is, instead of worrying about how it's going to affect me completely, I could think, can I be of use to others in this situation? Have I got an opportunity to make a contribution to this situation? So something bad again happens and we can think, oh, that's really difficult, I need to look after myself. Or we could think, oh, I wonder if I could turn it around and think how I might be able to contribute to this situation. So because we can start to retrain ourselves, we can start to create our own ideas of what the dreamlike dharmas, I suppose. We can try and make them positive ones, full of love, full of wisdom. And we can create things. So for instance, I think at the centre, we are trying to create a different dream of being in the world from others, for some others. So, you know, one that's based on love, one on generosity, one on friendliness, one on the dana economy, so what you can give rather than what you can take. So I suppose in a way I see that as creating a more positive dream. And it goes deeper than that, I think, because you could say that we dream, the kind of things that are deepest, most important to us are us dreaming our reality, as I've said. And one of the things that we do, I think, is we worship. We might think we don't worship anything, but we will be worshipping something. And what we can do is we can recreate and decide what we want to worship. So I'm going to read quite a long reading now from someone called David Foster Wallace, which I think he puts it incredibly well. So he gave this talk at a graduation ceremony in the United States. I think they have those big things where someone kind of comes and gives you like a really motivating talk. So what he says is, something that's weird but true. In the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there's actually no such thing as atheism. There is no such thing as not worshipping. Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship. And the compelling reason for maybe choosing some sort of God or spiritual type thing to worship, be it Jesus or Allah, be it the Wiccan Mother Goddess or the Four Noble Truths, or some inviolable set of ethical principles, is that pretty much anything else that you worship will eat you alive. If you worship money and things, if they are where you tap real meaning in life, then you'll never have enough. You'll never feel like you have enough. That's the truth. If you worship your body and beauty and sexual allure, you'll always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you'll die a million deaths before they finally grieve you. On one level, we know all this stuff already. It's been codified as myths, proverbs, cliches, epigrams, parables, the skeleton of every great story. The whole trick is keeping the truth up front in daily consciousness. If you worship power, you will end up feeling weak and afraid, and you will need even more power over others to numb you to your own fear. Worship your intellect, being seen as smart, you will end up feeling stupid, a fraud, always on the verge of being found out. But the insidious things about these forms of worship is not that they're evil or sinful, is that they're unconscious, they're default settings. They're the kind of worship you just gradually slip into day after day, getting more and more selective about what you see and how you measure value, without ever being fully aware that that's what you're doing. And the so-called real world won't discourage you from operating on your default settings, because the so-called real men, real world of men and money and power hums merrily along in a pool of fear and anger and frustration and craving and worship of self. Our own present culture has harnessed these forces in ways that have yielded extraordinary wealth and comfort and personal freedom. The freedom to be lords of our tiny, skull-sized kingdoms, alone at the centre of all creation. This kind of freedom has much to recommend it. But of course, there are all different kinds of freedom. And the kind that is most precious, you will not hear much talk about in the great outside world of wanting and achieving. The really important kind of freedom involves attention and awareness and discipline, and being truly able to care about other people and to sacrifice for them over and over in myriad petty, unsexy ways every day. That's real freedom. That's being educated and understanding how to think. The alternative is unconsciousness, the default setting, the rat race, the constant gnawing sense of having had and lost some infinite thing. So, that's David Foster Wallace, and if you haven't come across it before, his talk is called something like The Water We Swim In, and it's really worth looking up. So, he talks really clearly there, I think, about if we don't choose what we worship, but we put it at the centre of our lives, would be another way to talk about it, it will be chosen for us. We will be dreamed by our society in some ways. We'll be dreamed by our culture. So what we need to do is decide what we want to dream ourselves. And sometimes seeing through the stories, the way I've been talking about wisdom, can feel a little bit intellectual, like it's of the mind. Though actually that's not my experience, that when I have let go of stories and seen through dreams, I suppose, I often feel it quite embodied. That's how I experience. But I think it's really important that we don't see wisdom as just being an intellectual thing. Wisdom is of the heart. Wisdom is an emotional response. And one way that we can... I suppose, encourage our dreams, our worship, develop our dreams, is to use our imagination to connect with the archetypal. And I'm going to talk a little bit about a figure called Pranayaparamita, who is the kind of figure that perhaps we might bring to mind if we want to make a conscious decision of what we worship, or what we think is the most important in our lives. So Pranayaparamita is how you spell her name. She's... Pranya means wisdom and paramita means perfection. And interestingly, I talked about the Diamond Sutra and the Heart Sutra, and they come from a collection of Buddhist writings called the Pranayaparamita, which really vary. They vary from, I think one of them's like 10,000 lines, down to one which is just a single letter, which is A or A, which means not, which is interesting. So A, it's not this, it's not this, it's not this. So what they're trying to get at is something beyond our everyday understanding of the world. I love the story that comes with the Pranayaparamita literature is that somebody called Nagarjuna was the first person to, not the first person, but anyway, he was a Buddhist figure, a teacher, a philosopher who wrote about these things. And the story goes that he got the teachings from the Naga princess. So the Nagas are a bit like dragons or snakes. They live right down at the bottom of lakes. So you can see them as, you know, perhaps our unconscious levels. And he went to a lake, and the Naga princess came up from the depths and gave him the Pranayaparamita teachings. So they're not teachings of the head, they're teachings from the depths. Okay, so Pranayaparamita is a female figure. If you were lucky enough to go to Adistana recently, you might have seen this sculpture there. So she is a mature woman. She is golden in colour. So this is the picture at Adistana. And this is at Taraloka. So some people also might meet at Taraloka Buddha Centre and seen this figure there as well. So she traditionally, not in those sculptures actually, but traditionally holds a book. She holds a vajra. She often holds a mala. And she sometimes holds blue lotuses and is seated on a blue lotus. So those symbols are really important. So I suppose there's something here about if we want to see the dreamlike nature of reality and we want to create our own dreams, we don't just do them on ideas and thoughts like I've been talking about. We also use concepts and archetypal images to do that. And, you know, you might connect to different ones in different ways, but this is just a little bit about Pranayaparamita. So she's the goddess of wisdom. She's golden in colour. She's made up of thousands of little Buddhas. So she's not a fixed form. She consists of lots of tiny little Buddhas. There's another picture of her as well. She's holding the book, the Pranayaparamita, the wisdom that goes beyond concepts and ideas. She holds the Vajra. The Vajra sees through reality. The Vajra is the diamond thunderbolt that cuts through our stories and our dreams. She has a mala. I don't know if she does in this picture, but she often has a mala. So a mala is like, you know, when people have beads around their neck. People have 108 beads, and people do mantras with those. And the reason she has a mala is because repetition is really important. We're not going to understand wisdom, break through to wisdom just straight away. There's something about we need to repeat things again and again and again. Okay. So she can represent to us something archetypal, a different way of seeing the world. So, I suppose what I've tried to do with this talk is say that by seeing all dharmas as dreamlike, see all dharmas as dreamlike, all phenomena as dreamlike, we can start to have more choice over our experience. We can choose how we respond to our experience. And we can steer our life towards a more helpful, more enjoyable dream. So that perhaps we can start to wake up from dreaming at all. We can all wake up from our delusions. And we can become the bodhisattvas that we all have the potential to be. Okay.